This is Sheldon Brown with, I hope, the first of many podcasts. My general plan for the podcast is to start out talking about bicycles and probably to end up talking about music. Today I want to talk about English three speeds. The classic English three speed was made pretty much through the entire length of the 20th century. The three speed hub was invented just around 1900. Actually, English bicycle manufacture pretty much ended around 2000 when the great factory in Nottingham, the Raleigh factory, was shut down. Throughout that time, the classic English three-speed bike was the transportation bicycle and the symbol of the British bicycle industry. The dominating manufacturer was Raleigh in Nottingham, England, which goes back also before the turn of the century. Raleigh got started, I think, in 1890-something. Their enormous factory in Nottingham was, for a long time, the largest industrial building in the world. In that Nottingham factory, they built pretty much every part of the bicycle, up until at least sometime in the early 60s. This is not the way the bicycle industry is run now. These days, when you buy a bicycle, the name that's painted on the down tube of the frame is usually going to be the name of a trading company. If it is a manufacturer, it's a manufacturer that basically buys the tubing from a tubing company and welds or otherwise connects the tubes together to make a bicycle frame, paints it, and then buys all of the other parts to make a complete bicycle from different parts manufacturers. That was not the way Raleigh did it. Raleigh made the spokes, they made the rims, they made the handlebars, they made the cranks, they made the sprockets, they made the gears. They made pretty much everything. The only parts they didn't make were the tires, which came from Dunlop, but they had a very tight relationship with Dunlop, and the saddles were from Brooks generally, and they also had a very strong relationship with Brooks, and in fact later on Raleigh owned Brooks for a long period of time. These bikes had a kind of integrity that you don't really see nowadays. Bikes nowadays are designed and built to sell. The designers basically look at ways they can make a bike jump out at you on the sales floor, and once you've plunked down your credit card and rolled out the door, their job is done and they really don't care anymore. That was not the case with the classic English three speeds. The people who built these bikes, the people who worked in the factories, also used the same bikes to get to work every morning and to go home at night. These bikes were not built to be toys or sporting equipment. They were built to be solid transportation vehicles. They were built for reliability and durability above all else. They weren't designed to be especially pretty. Most of them were black, but with very sturdy stove enamel paint jobs that would resist scratching. Indeed, I often say they were built to last 100 years. And probably many of them will. Research and development divisions of Raleigh and other British manufacturers continued to find ways to make them better all through the first half of the 20th century. Sometime around the early 60s, though, maybe the middle 60s, there was a fundamental change in philosophy. They decided they were good enough, and now they would start finding ways to make them cheaper. And they started looking for corners to cut, and the quality started a long, slow slide, which eventually led to the demise of the British bicycle industry. This actually is a pattern that was followed through much of British industry. It's also true of the motorcycle trade and the automobile industry. They came upon hard times, primarily because they decided they did not have to innovate anymore. This wasn't unique to England. The same thing happened to the French, and to a lesser extent to the Italians, although a little bit later in the case of the French. English three-speed bikes were not always available in the United States. The United States underwent a long dark ages of cycling. We were leaders in the cycling industry in the late 19th century and up until perhaps the First World War. But we were also, of course, leaders in the automotive industry. And the automotive industry pretty much eclipsed the bicycle industry. And from the time of the First World War and increasingly through the 50s and even into the 60s, the bicycle was basically considered to be a toy for children. You would almost never see an adult riding a bicycle. It would be considered childish and eccentric. This began to change, however, during World War II. The typical products made by the U.S. industry in this era were heavy, super strong bikes that were made with styling to make them look like motorcycles and to be very, very sturdy so that they would not break when children abused them. They were typically sized for children. Even the so-called full-size ones had dropped frames with a very low saddle. They were heavy and slow, but the manufacturers didn't care about that because they didn't expect anyone to actually use them to try to get anywhere. They were intended to just ride around the block or a couple blocks to the ball field or to school or whatever for children. This all began to change during World War II because hundreds of thousands of American servicemen found themselves in England in a time of gasoline rationing, or should I say petrol rationing. To get around, they pretty much all wound up picking up used bicycles, and the bicycles they got were the classic English three-speeds that had been left behind by British soldiers that had gone off to fight in North Africa or Burma or wherever. These bicycles were a revelation to Americans who had been brought up with these clumsy, clunky tank bikes put out by the U.S. manufacturers, and when the war ended, many of them actually brought bicycles back with them. Even the ones that didn't bring bicycles back started looking at their dealers to try to find a source for them. And British bicycles began to be imported again into the United States in ever-increasing numbers, all through the late 40s into the 50s. It was still a small niche market until the great bike boom of the early 1970s. Unfortunately, the great bike boom of the early 1970s also coincided with the rise of the 10-speed bike. Basically, in 1974, every baby boomer bought a 10-speed bicycle. Many of these people would have been much better off buying a 3-speed bicycle because most of these people were not serious cyclists, not hardcore cyclists, and the riding position and general configuration of the racer-type bicycle is not generally comfortable for a rider who doesn't do a lot of cycling or is not into speed. As a result, many of these baby boomer 10-speeds wound up spending most of their lives hanging up in garages or rusting away in cellars and attics. The people who had bought them would probably have been better served by a more traditional English three-speed. However, it did not seem to make sense at the time to go for the three-speed because it's obvious that 10 is more than 3, and the cost of the bikes was pretty comparable. The fact is that the three-speed internal gear mechanism is a very complicated piece of machinery and involves a lot of small parts that have to be made of very high-quality steel. Whereas a derailleur system can be made mainly out of cheap stampings or even plastic parts. So in practice, it turns out that the 10-speed bikes were not really any more expensive than the 3-speeds, but they were much more fragile. Now we're coming to a time when there seems to be a move toward bringing back internal gears. Shimano and the new owners of Sturmey Archer and SRAM are all offering multi-speed hubs, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8 speeds. There's a German company, Roloff, that offers one with 14 speeds, and it's to be hoped that there will be viable alternatives to the derailleur gearing. Internal gears have a number of major advantages over derailleur gearing. They are very much more durable and require much less maintenance because the workings are all contained inside the rear hub where they're protected from dirt and kept constantly lubricated. Another major advantage of internal gear systems is that you can shift them even when the bicycle is not in motion. This is not possible with derailleur gearing. I think that's all I have to say on this topic for now. I will come back to British bikes on another podcast. I'd like to talk about my very favorite band. This is a band from England, since we're on an English topic. They were originally called the Oyster Cayley Band and were originally a dance band back in the late 70s. They eventually dropped the name Cayley from their name and became the Oyster Band. And then in later rebranding, they dropped the article and became Oyster Band, just one word. They play a music that you would probably categorize as folk rock. They use a lot of folk elements and rock instrumentation, but that's a bit of an oversimplification because they also use an electric cello and accordion, instruments that are not normally associated with rock and roll, nor with folk music. Well, I guess the accordion and the concertina are. Their leader is a singer-songwriter named John Jones, a Welshman, who writes wonderful songs and sings beautifully. All of the other members of the band are extremely talented musicians, very original, very lively, and I think they're the best thing to come out of England since the Beatles. Anyway, I'm going to play a few samples. Because of copyright issues and so on, I'm not going to play any complete songs, but I'll play some parts of some of my favorite Oyster Band songs. Much of Oyster Band's music is political, to some extent at least, and that's certainly true of this song, Ashes to Ashes, from their 1987 album, Step Outside. This was actually the first song of the Oyster Band that really caught my attention, and here is an excerpt from it.
Some are born with a silver spoon, and some are born without a clue. Some are born to take the biscuit, some are born to just make do. When those fat cats drop the big one, they will turn a penny too. They will rent out nuclear shelters, we'll get one with an outside loo.
That was an excerpt from Ashes to Ashes from Step Outside. From the same CD, here's a section from Hal and Toe, which is a traditional folk song that probably deals with the Spanish Armada. The song Too Late Now comes from the Ride album of 1989 and talks about the general decline of the lot of the upper classes in Great Britain. Here's a part of it.
You bought up the props for a world that never was. Now there's holes in the scenery and less applause. We are all ungrateful bastards like the dog that your hand. All these years and you still don't understand
that it's too late now
for grace and favor.
Too late now
for your sunset shires.
Too late now
for your faithful servants.
Too late now
to play the squire.
Too late now
for second chances.
Too late now
for a change of heart. We'll all die laughing when this whole thing falls apart.
That was an excerpt from Too Late Now from the Oyster Band's Ride album of 1989. In 1992, they came out with an excellent album called Deserters. I'm going to play part of a song called Elena's Shoes. This deals with the revolution in Romania, and the Elena being spoken of is Elena Ceaușescu. This is a rather bitter song, but catchy.
Thank you.
left behind is a judgment, judgment. Stripped to the bone, no, it's 19 carat back outside ivory telephones. Black satin sheets, crates of German beer, pornographic movies, shattered chandelier, shark skin tuxedos, crystals on the sleeve, closets full of objects you would not believe. How can you use a thousand pairs of shoes when you got those walking boots? Just one pair had to do. So put yourself in Elena's shoes. They wouldn't give her time to choose, and she said I'd rather die. Said I'd rather die.
That was an excerpt from Elena's Shoes from the 1992 album Deserters. In 1997, they came out with an album called Deep Dark Ocean. Here's part of a song called Sail On By. That was Sail On By from Deep Dark Ocean. Another song from the same album, it's called Milford Haven, a little bit reminiscent of the Beatles' song She's Leaving Home, at least in terms of subject matter, if not in style.
Touch the scars upon his body, trace the veins beneath his skin. It felt so right to leave him sleeping, yet her head began to spin. And when she left no letter. What you don't say, no one hears. She shut the door on empty voices, on regret and wasted years. She saw the moon over Milford Haven, stars in a flaming sky. She stepped out into the sunrise, and she found that she could fly. When she felt her wings on fire, sun was at its height. Solway sands and Kielder water, far below her left and right. And somewhere north of Tobermory, they say her path began to climb. She was heading for Newfoundland, and she might be gone sometime.
That was an excerpt from Milford Haven from Deep Dark Ocean by Oyster Band. I hope these excerpts have whetted your appetite for Oyster Band and that you'll rush right out and buy all of their wonderful CDs. The three that I've played are probably my favorite, but all their stuff is quite good and worth looking for. Some of it's on Ryko Disc and some of it's on Cooking Vinyl, but you can find them if you look for them. And that's the end of this podcast from SheldonBrown.com. I hope you'll tune in for subsequent ones.